From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The record-breaking wildfires in California's Napa and Sonoma counties were the most devastating such disasters that the area has experienced in decades. Dozens of people died, and huge swaths of residential neighborhoods and vineyards were completely destroyed. Smoke and ash from the fires has now made its way into San Francisco, where residents are being forced to wear protective masks and schools are being temporarily shut. But what we have witnessed this fall may frighteningly be the new normal. A perfect set of conditions, lush vegetation from a wetter winter, a dry, hot summer, and strong winds fueled the fires and helped them sweep through large areas. Climate scientists are not surprised that this happened. My guest is Leroy Westerling, co-director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California. He just co-wrote Climate Drives Interannual Variability and Probability of High Severity Fire Occurrence in the Western United States for the journal Environmental Research Letters. And he wrote an article in the Guardian newspaper last year predicting the increased severity of wildfires. Welcome to the program, Leroy.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Explain the way in which these fires were fueled much faster. We, of course, in California, we have wildfires, not so much in the northern part of the state as in the southern part of the state. But these conditions that helped the northern California fires spread like crazy were a fairly unusual conglomeration of conditions, right?
Well, so we have... This is certainly an outlier season. If you look at the last 20 to 30 years, there have been other large fires in this region, but none as large as what we're seeing now, and certainly not all of them at the same time. But you have a region where it's a Mediterranean climate. It's warm and dry in the summer and into the fall, and that dry period overlaps with increasing winds into the fall. So we call them Diablos in Northern California and Santa Ana's in Southern California. And that combination of really dry fuel conditions at the end of the summer dry season, plus the wind intensifying into the fall, and the close proximity of a lot of homes and a lot of population centers that provide a lot of sources of ignition for fires can give you these really big fire seasons. And then on top of that, we had a very wet winter just recently following a multi-year, very extreme drought. And that very extreme drought is leaving some standing dead fuels on the landscape. And then we had a very wet winter that provided additional fuel. And the very warm temperatures that we had in spring and summer helped dry that fuel out enough that it could still burn the same year that it grew. Climate change is sort of driving an intensification of these risks in a couple of different ways. One is that it makes the precipitation more variable. So you have more extreme wet years and more extreme dry years. And then on top of that, we've had warmer temperatures for decades on end now globally. And regionally, we've seen very extreme temperatures, record temperatures in California as well. And what this does is that in the wet years, you have more evaporation and less of that moisture is carried over into the subsequent years as moisture in the ground, you know, so groundwater and in the vegetation. And then during the drought itself, conditions are going to be drier because one, you have less moisture carried over from the previous year, and the warmer temperatures during the drought year itself mean you have more evaporation then too. And so you just have less moisture overall to keep the fuels wet. Yeah. And so even though you get these spikes of years where it's very wet in the winter, and so you can grow more grass and things like that to help fuel the fires, overall, the system is drying out. And so our expectation has been that fire in coastal Northern California would come to look more and more like fire in coastal Southern California over time.
Right.
And at the same time, we are also seeing increases in fire around the Western United States. So it's not just coastal fires, right? It's forest fires in the Sierra Nevada and in the Rockies. And they've been increasing at different paces in different places, according to how the local conditions were in the past. So places where you have snow on the ground for a long period of time and are really moist and everything's a higher elevation mountains in California or in the Northern Rockies or in the Northwest can be particularly sensitive to warming temperatures. But even these coastal areas, the fire severity and size or that response to the warmer temperatures.
Now, does it matter how the fires start? Because there's a PG&E is being held responsible for a failing electrical grid that may have sparked the fire. I mean, at some level, when you have conditions that are so perfect for these huge fires, it's almost inevitable that a spark somewhere will catch, right?
I think that's right. One way to think about it is most of these fires in coastal California are human ignited. And there were a bunch of fires in this recent fire siege that's still ongoing. Not all of them were started by PG&E power grid, but they probably all started by people one way or another. When you have tens of millions of people living in proximity to these fuels and they're really flammable like this, there's always a surplus of ignitions. That's not the limiting factor for getting these fires going. It's the dryness of the fuels, and then the winds and the very dry fuels combined make it hard to put them out. So a lot of years we might have ignitions, but they get put out quickly. But right now it's difficult to do that because it spreads so quickly.
In the coverage of these devastating fires, are you seeing enough media bringing up the climate factor?
Well, so I am personally known for talking about the climate side of it, and I've been getting a lot of requests for interviews. So my own personal perception is, yeah, people are talking about this. I don't know if you know the majority of articles actually address climate or not, but it seems like it's pretty common thread right now.
And Jerry Brown, the governor of California, has decried how terrible this disaster is, the devastation. He has wanted to be known as a climate champion, but he has unfortunately also pushed climate change exacerbating policies, promoted fracking, etc. There are political solutions to this issue, but they just don't seem to be taken up fast enough. Are we going to, just from the research that you've done, do you have the sense that we are at a moment where the genie is already out there, which is the cat is out of the bag, the genie is out of the bottle, whatever metaphor you want to use, that we cannot avoid as much as simply try to mitigate now the issue of climate?
Well, a number of things. One is California is one of the most proactive governments in the world about climate change, not just mitigation, but also adaptation. And we've had four statewide climate assessments now funded by the legislature and the California Energy Commission. We're in the midst of the fourth one. And we've been showing people for over a decade now, close to two decades we've been working on this, how fire is going to change, how it's going to affect resources in the state, and how water resources and a lot of other important services from the natural world that we rely on are going to change with climate change. The truth is that California, like any other major economy in the world, needs to shift to a carbon-free, a carbon-neutral economy. And we're further along on that than most places are, actually. Now, in terms of changes being baked in, there's a long lag time between when we emit carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases and when it gets up into the atmosphere and when it has its fullest effect. I shouldn't say until, you know, it gets up in the atmosphere, but until it has its fullest effect.
Right.
And so we've already baked in a lot of climate change by mid-century.
We could stop emitting greenhouse gases today, and it wouldn't mean that we'd immediately lose the effects of climate change.
No, no one alive today will ever see the end of climate change. But the changes that we're projecting for mid-century, even if we stopped emitting right now, most of that would still happen because there's a lot of lags, like I said, and there's also natural sort of reinforcing processes that we're triggering that are going to take on a life of their own for a while. But if we don't take really concerted efforts to limit our continued emissions of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, then that makes a huge difference by the latter half of the century. So by the time you get to 2060, 2075, 2085, it makes a huge difference in whether or not we have climate change that we can easily adapt to or not. Right now, you know, if we stayed on a trajectory where we sort of follow the worst case scenarios that we've been following for a while globally, then it would be very difficult on a lot of different dimensions, not just wildfire, for everyone to adapt and still have, you know, a civilization that provides the comforts and services that we expect.
Are there things that that you know of that can be taken up by local authorities to mitigate the worst of these wildfires? I mean, you know, we can't do much at this point in the short term about strong winds and wetter winters, but are there some simple things that can be taken up?
Well, so when we're building, when we're developing communities in the wildland-urban interface, so proximate to these fuels, we can pay more attention to their spatial footprint, right? So we can cluster development and surround it by open space where we aggressively manage the fuels so that they have a buffer zone and a place where it's feasible for firefighters to defend the community from these.
Right, because fires. We saw fires just jumping from one house to the other in the Santa Rosa fires, and just terrifying because the houses were, whatever, 10, 20 feet apart.
Yeah, and then newer homes in California have, you know, pretty strict regulations in terms of the kinds of materials that they use and things like screening gaps into the attic and things like that to keep the embers out of the attic. And those homes are much more resilient to fire than homes that were built previously. So retrofitting homes that are already built that don't meet the current code would make a big difference as well. And then if you're looking at locations, say in the foothills of Sierra Nevada mountains, for example, we could do more to thin fuels in places where they've gotten really dense because of the legacy of a half century and more effective fire suppression.
So finally, Leroy, is there more research needed on how climate change fuels wildfires? Or, I mean, is this an issue that, you know, you can sort of put to rest just scientifically and move on to the political work? It's known. Climate scientists get it, and they've been predicting that this is going to be happening for years. So you were probably one of the few people who wasn't surprised by what happened in Northern California.
So it depends how you think about it. The kind of modeling and projection that I do looks into the future, and it takes the relationships between climate, fire, and fuels that we observed in the recent past, and it projects them into the future. And it allows you to see sort of the trajectory of change and the interannual variability, you know, the variability from year to year in fire in different parts of the Western United States. But the further out you look, the less relevant those relationships become because the vegetation changes, right? Another type of analysis looks at where different types of vegetation grow in the landscape today because of the climate it has. And it tries to map those types of vegetation and the kind of fire they have onto where we think the climate is going to be on the landscape in the future. And the problem is that doesn't really tell you how you get from where we are today to where we might be 500 or 1,000 years from now when we have a stable climate again. Hmm. And that intermediate period, which is the period we have to manage for the next 100 years, is basically completely dominated by transition effects. Because it's not like climate changes once and it's done. Climate change is continuously going to be accelerating throughout the lives of basically everyone who's alive today. And we don't have any recent historical or reconstructed prehistorical analog that we can look at to see how that rate of change in climate plays out in a landscape like we have today, where there's lots of people, lots of management, and lots of fuels that are vulnerable to fire. So we really don't understand the dynamics of how we're going to get from where we are today to some future situation centuries hence. And we really don't even understand that past, say, the next few decades. So there's a lot of work to be done. It's very difficult work to do, actually, looking at sort of dynamic modeling of the vegetation and the fire and the climate interacting with each other. And that's something that's ongoing now and starting to bear some results, but it's a long way from telling us what we need to do to preserve examples of the kinds of landscapes that we like to have on the land.
Well, we'll post links to the work that you've done on our website later today. Leroy, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
My guest is Leroy Westerling, co-director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California. And he has been writing and researching about how climate change fuels the severity of wildfires. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.